All right, let's go ahead and get started. Last session of the day, good afternoon. Is this thing on? I said good afternoon. There it is, all right, good. I know you're tired, I know it's been a long day, and I know I'm in between you and the festivities at Ask the Experts later, but, excuse me, this is a pretty important session for those of you who haven't yet deployed Exchange 2013. How many of you are still on 2007? All right. How many of you are on 2010? Who's already at 2013? Okay. So most of this content is about deploying 13. If you're already at there, you've done that. So this will maybe help you do future deployments. How many of you are at 2013 but have to deploy it from scratch or do an upgrade again? All right. Good. Okay. So the agenda is fairly straightforward. We're going to talk about preparing for deployment. Things that you need to do before you start preparing for Exchange 2013. Then we'll talk about what it takes to actually do a deployment. I'll walk you through an overview of the steps, and then we'll dive deep into each of the things that you need to do in this case, deploy Exchange 2013. And we'll also talk about upgrades from 2007 and 2010 as well. How many of you are running public folders? All right, and how many of you are interested in taking your public folders to Exchange 2013 modern public folders? All right, good. We'll have some guidance for you today there as well. All right, so let's start with the prepping, preparing for deployment. I would hope that those of you who've been doing Exchange for a while are familiar with all of the tools that I'm going to talk about today, but I wanted to list them all to make sure that everybody understands that we have all of these tools, all of this guidance available to you that can really reduce the amount of time it takes to do your deployment, provide you with a smoother deployment, provide you with a deployment that more quickly provides you with a return on investment and something that more quickly meets your expectations as well. So the first tool is really indispensable. It's called the Exchange Deployment Assistant. How many of you have heard of this tool? All right, how many of you have used this tool? All right, that's great. So if you haven't heard of this tool, it is the place that you want to go to start your Exchange 2013 deployment, whether you're doing an upgrade from 2007 or 2010, whether you're doing a hybrid deployment, so you've got some on-premises and some in the cloud, even if you're doing a greenfield deployment, so you don't have any messaging system, you're putting 2013 in there brand new, or if you're doing a cloud-only deployment. So if you also want to deploy Office 365 in production, the Exchange Deployment Assistant would be a great place to start because it'll hook you into the Office 365 deployment guidance. Then there's the server role requirements calculator. Who's heard of this? Now, who's used its predecessor, the storage calculator that we had? All right. So probably most of you have heard of it. Here again is another tool that if you haven't heard of it, you absolutely need to go and get it. This tool we distribute from the Exchange Team blog. It's an Excel workbook that we provide you with. It's Excel 2013, so you will need a 2013 viewer to use it. But the version that we have for Exchange 2013 is significantly advanced over the previous versions that we had. That's actually one of the reasons we changed the name from the storage calculator to the server role requirements calculator, because now it's doing a lot more than just storage. It will also help you with network bandwidth, database availability group design and build, database layout, storage design, backup design, if you're using backups or native protection, and so forth. It is very, very full-featured. It also has this new tab where if you are deploying in a resilient fashion, and hopefully all of you are, you can actually play with it and simulate faults. And so you can see where your databases are going to move in failure modes. In a site resilient configuration, you can also simulate failures of the WAN, of servers, and so forth, and get a feel for how your system will respond based on the guidance in the calculator. And as I said earlier, it will also help you build out your system as well. Now with a one-button click, you can generate these PowerShell scripts that will build the DAG for you, create the databases for you, lay them out the way the tool thinks it should, and so forth. Then there's the Remote Connectivity Analyzer. Who's heard of this one? All right. This one's been around for a while. This is another free tool that you'll actually use both during the deployment process, especially on upgrade scenarios, and you'll also use it post-deployment as well, anytime that you make configuration changes that might affect external client access. So firewall rule changes, certificate changes, IP resubnetting, et cetera, anything that could affect external access, this tool would be designed to help you validate and correct problems if they're detected. Then, of course, jet stress. Who's heard of jet stress? I would expect almost all hands to go up. JetStress is our old storage validation tool. It simulates ESE, our database activity on your storage, usually during a 24 or 48 hour burn-in period, and it basically validates the storage that the calculator told you to buy, that you purchased from your storage vendor, does in fact meet the IOPS required by your deployment. Now, hopefully, many of you already know that we've reduced IOPS over version to version to version. So I want to start with a quick question, and this one is going to be for a wristband that will get you into the Office 365 party later on this evening. So it's valuable even if you can't attend tonight, because this will be like currency. So I have a wristband and card here, and I'm wondering, don't shout it out so we can make it fair. I'm wondering if somebody can tell me, what was the reduction in IOPS that we have going all the way back from 2003 to 2013? Okay, one person back there knows it. Of course, it'd have to be way back there. You better get it right. Okay.
75.
No, it's not 75. Okay, now we're going up at the front. I think the gentleman in red had his first, so after he's now seems to have looked it up on the internet.
95,
you got it, sir. Good job. 95% reduction in IOPS going from Exchange 2003 to 2013. Roughly 70% reduction from 2003 to 2007. Another 70% from 2007 to 2010. And then about 50 to 70%, depending on the client, with 2013. So that'll all average out to about 95%. All right, and the last one, load generator. Who's heard of that? All right, and just like JetStress is designed to simulate database activity to stress the storage, load simulator or load generator is there to simulate client activity against the servers as well. So you'll have a good idea as to how your clients will behave once you acquire the hardware. There are other tools as well. We also have a client bandwidth calculator available that's very similar to the server role requirements calculator and so forth. You can check the appendix of this slide deck for other tools that you'll find useful. All right, so there's been some fairly significant changes going from Exchange 2010 to Exchange 2013. And the same is true if you're coming from 2007 as well. The architecture in 2007 and 2010 were very, very similar. And now they've been radically changed with the introduction of 2013 back in late 2012. One way to actually think about it, if this helps, is think of Exchange 2010 as the last version in the old architecture and 2013 as the first version in the new architecture. So I'm just going to let this slide build, and then I'll talk about some of these changes here. So in 2010, we had five server roles, the four internal ones, hub, CAS, mailbox, and unified messaging. Edge outside of the perimeter network. We largely had this goal of having these server roles be what we would call loosely coupled, but the actual execution of our code and the implementation of it ended up making these server roles very tightly coupled. They depended on one another for functionality from a user perspective, from a geolocation perspective, and from other perspectives as well. The way we had things architected was also fairly complex. You had to have a fairly complex load balancer in front of 2010, what we would typically refer to as a layer 7 load balancer. That simply means a load balancer that maintains application session affinity at the load balancer layer. So I'm always talking to the same client access server, otherwise it breaks my session affinity. And then the three middle tier roles, CAS, Hub, and UM, that's where we had things like the authentication code, the proxy and redirection code, the protocols, the APIs, the business logic inside of Exchange that makes it do certain things. And then down in the mailbox role, we had what we called mailbox assistance. We also had the information store and content indexing. In 2013, we split things out. We took the three middle tier roles and we added them into the mailbox role. So the client access server, the hub transport server, the unified messaging server, and of course the mailbox server now all live in the mailbox server role in Exchange 2013. And in its place, we completely rewrote and introduced a brand new client access server, and that is simply there for authentication, proxying, and redirection. You can think of it as a lightweight stateless protocol proxy, whereas everything else that you've known about Exchange now exists inside the mailbox role. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the upgrade path. We'll first start with Exchange 2010. I'm going to give you a high-level overview of the steps, then we'll repeat the same thing for 2007. There's only a couple differences between the paths, and then we'll get into each of the steps in depth so you know what to expect as you start doing each of these things. So here what we have is we've got a typical organization. We've got two sites, an internet-facing site, so it has an external URL associated with it, a namespace that clients can get to from the internet. And then we've got an intranet site, so all traffic to the intranet site gets proxied through the internet-facing site. Now, in this example, we've got Exchange 2010. And a couple client namespaces, the AutoDiscover and the mail namespace. In this particular animation, just to illustrate a few things, I've broken out the individual server roles, but hopefully you know that in Exchange 2010 and continuing in 2013, we want you to deploy multi-role implementations. So normally you would see all the server roles on the same servers, but again, it's just broken out here for animation purposes. Okay, so to start with the upgrade, the first thing that you need to do is you've got to verify some prerequisites. This simply means that you have to make sure that the legacy, or the existing, in this case, 2010 Exchange servers in your environment, have the minimum level of updates necessary in order to introduce Exchange 2013. You will always need to have updates available on your most recent version of Exchange when you're introducing a newer one. That is how we teach the down level one about changes in the newer one, where we can. So here, the first thing in the case of Exchange 2010, you have to install a minimum of Service Pack 3, preferably, of course, Service Pack 3 with the latest update rollup. And this has to be installed on every Exchange 2010 server you have in your org, including your Edge Transport servers if you have them. Okay, and this needs to be done before you can proceed. Then the next thing is to, if you want, independently prepare the Active Directory schema by just having Exchange setup make the necessary schema changes to your Active Directory. That is something, as in previous versions, you've been able to do separately with the setup tools we give you, or you can simply install your first Exchange 2013 server and let it make the changes for you. Either way that's going to happen, you will have an Active Directory schema upgrade in your environment. Then you'll want to validate existing client access. Before you start introducing new versions of Exchange, you just want to make sure that everything is okay and good to go. So tools like the Best Practices Analyzer and tools like the Remote Connectivity Analyzer can do that for you. Once the tools say everything's good to go, then you can proceed with step two. And step two is installing Exchange 23. And in this case, you're going to install both roles, preferably on the same server, although we do support separating them. There's really not really any good reasons to do that, though. We'd really like them on the same role. So do that. If you are separating, the order in which you install them doesn't matter, but you do need them both in each site. The fact of the matter is one role is completely useless without the other. CAS, remember, is just a lightweight protocol proxy. It has to proxy everything to mailbox. So if there's no mailbox, it has nowhere to proxy to. And mailbox can only be communicated with through CAS. So if you install mailbox, which is where the objects and the logic live, CAS can't get to it if it doesn't exist, so you can't log into mailbox. So you need both roles. Then you're going to need certificates. Now, in the case of Exchange 2010, 2010 and 2013 can share the same namespace, which means they can use the same certificates. So if you want, you can simply export your certificates from your Exchange 2010 servers and import them into your Exchange 2013 servers. Again, if you're splitting the roles, you'd only need to do that for your CAS servers. You don't have to worry about certificate management on mailbox servers anymore with Exchange 2013. Those use self-signed certificates that the system itself manages. CAS, that's where you work with certificates. So in this case, you put them on 2013 CAS. Then you're going to make the namespace switch. And really, it sounds like something fancy, but it's nothing more than going into DNS and changing the record so that instead of pointing to the layer 7 load balancer that you had in front of 2010, they're now pointing to a different load balancer in front of your 2013 infrastructure. And that could be a layer 7 or a layer 4 load balancer because we've reduced the requirements. Remember, CAS is just a stateless protocol proxy, and we've changed client access to HTTP, so we don't need a layer 7 load balancer anymore. You can still use one, but we don't need one. We only need something that maintains TCP affinity or layer 4. So you make that change. You change your primary namespaces, your auto-discover namespace, your mail namespace, etc., and then you validate that the change is working properly using the remote connectivity analyzer. And of course, it doesn't hurt to test an administrator mailbox or your own mailbox as well. All right, then next you would go ahead and start moving mailboxes. So here, hopefully, you're deploying all on-premises deployments in a database availability group. So you'll create a DAG, and then you'll move the mailboxes from 2010 to 2013. This will be an online move, just like it was if you came from 2007, so the users will not be impacted by this. They will have full access to send and receive email in their entire mailbox as the move is going on, and before and after, of course. All right, after you've moved all of your mailboxes, that's when you can move your public folders. If you move the public folders first, then mailboxes that are stuck in the old system won't have access to it. But 2013 mailboxes can access public folders in both places. So public folders get moved last. And then the last thing you would do is you would repeat for each additional site that you have. The recommendation would be to go one site at a time, doing your internet-facing sites first, and then your intranet-facing sites thereafter, again, one at a time. All right, so that's the high-level steps for 2010. Again, we're going to get deep into each one so you can understand what you actually have to do. And then for 2007, I'll walk you through it a little bit quicker because most of the steps are the same. There's just a couple that are slightly different because of some legacy stuff we have to do with 2007. So, of course, you're going to install the proper updates. This is going to be for 2007, a minimum of SP3 plus RU10. Hopefully, you'll be on a later update, but this is the minimum. You'll also do the AD prep, either separately or with the first server install. Again, your choice, and then you'll validate client access. You'll install and introduce both 2013 roles into the organization, and then here's something that you have to do different for 2007. You have to create what we call a legacy namespace, and this legacy namespace is used so that 2013 can redirect 2007 mailbox users over to their mailbox silently. This can be any name that you want. It's just going to be a DNS record pointing to the 2007 systems. Some customers have taken us quite literally and created namespaces called legacy dot whatever their domain is, and that's fine. You can do that. But there's nothing in the code that's looking for the word legacy or anything like that. So really any namespace that you want. Old Exchange could be your namespace, or 2007 Exchange, you know, anything that you want. Put that in DNS, and then that's also going to have to go on your certificates as well. So if you are coming from 2007, you will have to acquire new certificates that have your legacy namespace on there, and those certificates will have to go to all of your 2007 servers, all of your 2013 CAS servers, and then if you're doing SSL offloading at other points of termination of SSL as well. So those are really the only differences with 2007. After that, you're just changing the primary namespace and validating it with the remote connectivity analyzer. You're building out the DAG. You're moving mailboxes. This will also be an online mailbox move. Then you're migrating to public folders after all of your mailboxes are done. And then similarly, you would repeat for additional sites. And actually, I realize now that we really can't say repeat for additional sites here because we need to move all mailboxes in all sites before you do the public folder transition. So I'll reinforce that when we get to the public folder stuff. All right, let's talk about prepping for Exchange 2013. Let's dig into each of these steps, as you can see by the numbered circles in there. So the green means it applies to 2010. The red means it applies to 2007. So in this case, you can see that this is going to apply to both of them in terms of the prerequisites. Doesn't matter where you're coming from, we have minimum prerequisites for deploying Exchange 2013 in your environment and minimum supported client access methods as well. So We've already talked about the legacy prerequisites. It's got to be 2010 SP3 or later. We are way beyond SP3 in terms of updates, so hopefully you're way longer than that. And same thing, 2007 SP3 RU10 or later. We still have several updates past RU10 out. Hopefully you're running those. For Outlook, we always support the current Outlook client minus 2. So that's Outlook 2013, Outlook 2010, and Outlook 2007. We do have minimum required versions, but as you can see, those are quite old at this time, and I would hope that all of you are running way later versions than that. If you're not, though, that is the minimum required. But of course, we would always recommend that you're running our very latest updates for Outlook. And if you're running things like Outlook 2013 with Office 2013 and click to run, that update process can be very easy for your users to keep up with. Now, for pre-Service Pack clients, pre-SP1 clients, there is one communication method for Outlook, and that is using RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere. In Service Pack 1 for Exchange 2013 and for Outlook 2013, we introduced a new second protocol called MAPI over HTTP. Who's heard of MAPI over HTTP? All right. So MAPI over HTTP, the only difference is we simply remove the RPC portion of the transport layer of that communication. So we're still talking MAPI, and we still use RPC communication within Exchange, but we just no longer use it between Outlook and Exchange. Now we take the MAPI verbs, wrap them in HTTP, and tunnel them right into the system that way. We also do support non-Windows Outlook clients, Outlook for the Mac 2011, and Entourage 2008 for the Mac that supports Exchange web services. Yes, sir. Great. So the question is, if we are completely on Exchange 2013 SP1 and Outlook 2013 SP1, can I completely remove the RPC feature of the server? No, you cannot. Now, we'll still need RPC technology. Otherwise, we're just not using it between the two clients, or between that client and the server. All right, so prerequisites, obviously a 64-bit operating system. And just as before with the client side, with Windows, we also support the latest version, minus 2. So Windows 2012 R2 is supported with Exchange 2013 SP1 and later, which hopefully all of you are running. Otherwise, if you're not going to deploy that, which you should, I mean, there's no reason to, you could also deploy that on Windows Server 2012 and Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1. Of course, we'd always recommend Windows 2012 R2. You get the best experience with that because things like the .NET framework and PowerShell are already built in, and you don't have to go get them separately to install them. Otherwise, there's some IIS and Windows components that we need. All of this can be automatically installed by Exchange Setup. That's actually something we've been able to do since Exchange 2010. So that stuff, we're pretty much just telling you it's required, but it's nothing you have to install yourself. Pretty much the only thing you're going to have to install yourself is this UCMA that we use on both the client access server and the mailbox server role for the unified messenger role. That doesn't come with Windows. That will always be a separate download that you'll have to get. All this other stuff, you could have either Windows install natively or have Exchange installed for you. Yes, sir. Say that one more time, please.
For 2010, you needed to install the Office filter pack.
Ah, yes.
Is that deprecated now?
Ah, great question. So you don't need the Office filter pack anymore. And the reason for that is we have changed search engines. In 2010 and 2007, we used Microsoft Search, which effectively became a dead product inside of Microsoft during the 2010 development days. So what we did is a few years ago, we bought a company called Fast out of Oslo, Norway. And we bought their search engine technology and incorporated it into Exchange 2013 and SharePoint 2013. And we call it Search Foundation now. And Search Foundation has all of that built-in iFilters, including PDF, so you don't have to install PDF filters anymore. And that also means that you don't need to install the Office filter pack. Now, there is some benefits to installing the Office Filter Pack. There's a couple filters that you don't normally get, and it's support for publisher files and transport searching. So if you use a lot of Microsoft Publisher files, then you can optionally install the Office Filter Pack, but it's no longer required like it was before. All right, so we talked about installing the necessary updates. Next would be the Active Directory Schema Prep, and how you do it, again, is up to you. You can do it as a separate step using these individual steps to prepare the schema itself, and then to prepare the Exchange org, and then to prepare all your individual domains, or you can simply install Exchange and let Exchange do it. So which way should you do? That's a choice that's up to you. Typically, if you have a very large Active Directory environment, you might want to think about doing the schema updates separately because you got to wait for replication to go out everywhere before you can proceed with stuff. And that could take some time in a very large environment. If you're in a small Active Directory environment and things replicate very quickly, then you might just let Exchange do the schema extensions and the domain prep during the first server role setup. Again, it's up to you. All right. For deploying Exchange 2013, setup is very similar to what we had in 2010, although there are some significant differences. So as an example, in 2010, we had setup.com and setup.exe. Setup.com would launch the command line version. Setup.exe would launch the GUI version. Well, there's no two of them anymore. Now it's just setup.exe, and if you run it without parameters, it will launch the GUI version. If you run it with parameters, it will launch the command line version. So just one version of setup. And you will always install using our latest update. So you don't go and get RTM and then put CU1, CU2, et cetera on it. You just go get whatever our latest cumulative update or service pack is. Right now it's CU6. CU7 is imminent and coming very soon, so if you were deploying in a few months, you most likely would be deploying CU7, and that gets you the latest bits. Now, one thing you want to be aware of is when you install a cumulative update or a service pack on top of an existing deployment, that is the full product going back in. So what ends up happening is setup uninstalls the existing product and then installs whatever the latest bits are. So what that means is you'll have to do pretty good change management to track any changes that you might make in, say, for example, Exchange's configuration files or web.config files or any other customizations you might make to the system that would affect bits inside the Exchange program directory. Those will all get wiped out when you install a cumulative update or a service pack. So keep that in mind. Now, we also have some new command line parameters, in particular this long one here, this I accept Exchange Server license term. There's no way to abbreviate it. It doesn't have to be in Pascal case, but it does have to be typed exactly like that any and every time that you're doing a command line install. Okay? It's just a change we had to make to enforce our license agreement. All right. Now, let's talk about creating the legacy namespace then. Again, this is something you only need to do for Exchange 2007 coexistence. So remind me, how many of you are coming from Exchange 2007? Okay, if you're coming from 2007, this only applies during coexistence. So what that means is if you can do a very quick migration, maybe migrate everybody over a weekend so there is no coexistence, you don't need the legacy namespace. But if it's going to take you a while, if it's going to be a long time before you can migrate all the mailboxes, as long as you're in a state where you've got an Exchange 2007 mailbox user that's coming through 2013, you have to have this legacy namespace. You're in a coexistence model at that point. But if you're skipping that model, you can skip the legacy namespace altogether. If you can do a quick shotgun, you don't need this. If you do need it, you're creating a DNS record in both internal and external DNS. Hopefully you're using split DNS per our recommendation. If you're not, create it in whatever appropriate DNS zones that your Exchange 2013 servers and clients can access. And then you'll validate that using the Exchange Remote Connectivity Analyzer by having it test an Exchange 2007 mailbox. All right, certificates. We have done some work to make certificates better in Exchange 2013. Okay, we haven't gotten to the point where you don't need them. You're still going to need them for SSL, but we've made things almost as easy as they could get. We've got a new end-to-end certificate wizard inside the Exchange Admin Center that you can use to do a certificate request. Very similar to the ones that you may have used on various third-party websites for getting the certificates that you've used before. We've also made it very easy to move that certificate around. I can take a certificate, import it into one server, and then have it deployed on all my other client access servers. And then we've also introduced alerting, which is what you see here inside the Exchange Admin Center. So anytime the administrator logs in, they're going to get a notice. The first alert will come in 30 days prior to expiration that their certificate is going to expire. And if they don't take action and the certificate remains in that state, then every day we're going to give them another notice that the cert is going to expire. Okay, this is something we're trying to bubble up to the administrator so that something important like a certificate can be managed properly. All right. Now, some certificate best practices. We want you to minimize the number of certificates that you have to buy. And we want you to minimize the number of host names that go on the certificates, because the more host names and the more certificates, the more it costs you to deploy Exchange. And we want to keep costs low. So our recommendation is to use what we would call a unified namespace, the same namespace throughout your organization, no matter where your servers are located or where your users are located. We also recommend using subject alternative name certificates. SAN certs and wildcard certs are the two kinds of certificates that you can use that have multiple names on them. And we do support wildcard certificates. We don't recommend them, though, because of the security implications. If you get one of those certificates for an organization, you could spoof any server in that organization. And we don't like the idea of that, although we support it because it's cheaper for some customers. But we would recommend using SAN certificates instead. That allows you to get the names that you want on there without allowing any name to be spoofed. We also don't have any requirements to list the machine names in the certificate. If you end up having to do this, it will likely be because it was driven by integration from other products. So as an example, if you're using unified messaging and your telephony or your SIP or your VoIP equipment requires the actual server name for SSL communication, that might drive the host name to your certificate. If you're integrating with Link, some of the requirements with Link might drive server names to your certificates and so forth. But we don't need that for Exchange. Yes, sir. Great question. So the question is, do we recommend having internal PKI used for the certificates between the internal servers and the load balancer between the outside? So we actually don't have any specific recommendations around that. That would be up to the individual customer if they wanted to do that. The downside with doing that, though, is their client is going to go through that path, which means your PKI has to also be on all your clients as well. So that could be a really limiting factor for you. If you can touch all the clients and you've got that, then yeah, that might be something that would work for you. That's nothing that we do, for example, in Office 365. We just terminate right at the CAS all the way through. Yep. All right. So in terms of certificates, how many of you actually use wildcard certificates? Anybody? Okay, a few of you. Okay. So hopefully you understand what I mean when I talk about the security implications. Microsoft, for example, will never have wildcard certificates issued for star.microsoft.com because, again, those would be very dangerous if they got into the wrong hands. If long as you have good certificate control, though, you might find using wildcard certificates to be a good experience. And again, we support them, but excuse me. There are some changes that we made to the Outlook providers. And so Outlook actually will now dynamically build up its provider string, so it won't be populated the way that you may used to be seeing it when you're using a wildcard certificate. It usually just has that one in there. Now we actually need it for both providers. They both have to be wildcard ready in order to use it because Outlook is taking the information from both providers and tying it together into a single Outlook provider for the clients. All right, moving the client namespaces. So this basically is switching to CAS 2013 at this point. In advance of actually making the DNS cutover We would recommend that you go change the time to live for all the namespace records you're going to configure to a much lower TTL, maybe something as low as 5 minutes, because it will actually be the DNS record change that will be the trigger for clients to make that actual cutover. Until they pick up the new DNS record, they're still going to be going to the other place. And you want it to be low because not only will operating systems cache that, but also web browsers have their own separate name cache as well. And you're, of course, not going to expect your users to have to know how to clear them both or interrupt their sessions. So low TTL is really the way to go here. After you make the change, the TTL change and the cutover change, test with the remote connectivity analyzer. It's very good at telling you why it couldn't connect, if there are problems in the configuration. And then if necessary, you might have to reconfigure some of the virtual directory settings on your legacy servers, depending on if you're coming from 2007 or 2010. You're going to have to enable Outlook Anywhere on all of your legacy servers if it's not enabled already, because again, that is the only communication protocol we allow with Outlook now, aside from MAPI over HTTP. You are hopefully going to possibly move systems into production AD sites. So one trick to avoid all client access coming to a machine is to install all of your new servers into a dummy AD site that you create. After the server's all configured and ready to go, then you can move it into the production site, the production AD site, and clients can start seeing it, and other servers will start seeing it, and so forth. And then update your publishing methods. So load balancers, reverse proxies, whatever you're using, go and make the necessary rule changes to point, again, to the 2013 load balancers. Make the DNS updates. Once again, test with the remote connectivity analyzer after the DNS updates propagate. If you're in an area of the world where DNS replication and updates happens a little slower, you might just go ahead and change the host file on the machine you're using to test. That's a quick and easy way to go ahead and make sure things are working. Then test again once the DNS changes have propagated. All right, so from an Outlook Anywhere standpoint, there's going to be some authentication changes that you'll need to make as well. Here again, this could be 2007 or 2010. And what we'll want you to do here is, again, we need Outlook Anywhere enabled on all your legacy CAS. Is there anybody not using Outlook Anywhere in 2007 or 2010? Okay, so if you had your hand up, this is the extra step you'll need to do. You have to enable Outlook Anywhere. Once you've done that, you have to have on all of your legacy CAS for IIS authentication, it has to be NTLM. Clients can be basic. That's just an example here using basic. So clients could also be NTLM as well. So if you want that, do that. And then do a, again, that low TTL a couple days before you actually make the DNS changes. Something around 5 minutes is fine. After you've done the cutover and after all the clients are starting to use the 2013 namespace, maybe 2, 3, 4 days later, depending on how often your clients hit the server, then you can go back into DNS and increase that TTL so it's not refreshing every 5 minutes again. All right. OAuth single sign-on. How many of you use Outlook Web App as one of your primary clients? All right. So the experience is very good in a coexistence scenario. Here again, I've just split out the server roles for animation purposes. Normally, both roles we would want on both systems. So here what we have, we've made the cutover. Now we've got an OAuth client that's using the namespace mail.contoso.com. They're going through the layer 4 load balancer that's in front of the 2013 servers. They'll talk to IIS. IIS is going to do a couple things. Those things will result in finding out who this user is, authenticating them, and locating what version of Exchange their mailbox is running and where that mailbox is located. Here you can see IIS found that the mailbox in this case was on the 2010 side. So IIS will go ahead and proxy that from 2013 over to 2010, and then 2010 CAS will talk RPC to the store. And again, hopefully CAS and mailbox are on the same role, so we're talking local RPC at this point. Now, let's say we have a different site here. So the first two were in the same site, now we've added a new site, but of course it's also running Exchange 2010 in this coexistence scenario. Same user goes through OAuth, IIS does the lookup, finds out that they're over here instead, and does the same proxy across the site boundary to the 2010 CAS, and the 2010 CAS will talk RPC again to the 2010 mailbox server. Simple cross-site proxy request. We did something very similar when you were going from 2007 to 2010. All right, so let's say this other site now, instead of needing a proxy, it has its own namespace. So now we have a place to redirect to. So we've got two sites, one that's mail.contoso.com and the other one that's europe.mail.contoso.com. User comes in, they go through the load balancer, IIS does the lookup, finds that their mailbox is over here in this site, but it also finds out that this site has an external URL associated with it, that europe.mail.contoso.com. And that's the flag that tells OWA that you need to redirect. So CAS sends a redirect up to the client, and then the client redirects automatically to europe.mail.contoso.com, which then that CAS server talks RPC. Pretty simple stuff. And this is a cross-site silent redirect. In other words, this will just happen automatically. There's no URL that the user has to click. There's no re-entering their password or anything. It's single sign-on and a silent redirection right into their mailbox. All right, 2007, a little bit different because remember 2007 has that legacy namespace associated with them. So very similar setting. We've got a single site, but now we've got two namespaces, mail.contoso.com for users on 2013 and legacy.contoso.com for users on 2007. OWA user comes in, talks to 2013, IIS does the lookup and finds out that their mailbox is on 2007. So it will do an automatic same site silent redirect over to that legacy namespace. So just like the cross site silent redirect you saw in the previous animation, this is going to be single sign on. They're going to go right into their mailbox. Okay? But that's why you have to have the legacy namespace set up, and that's why it has to be on your certificates to enable that behavior. All right, so they'll go through and the same process will happen there. Now let's introduce another site. This site is intranet facing. It does not have its own namespace at this time. So the user will come in. We find out that their mailbox is over here, and we will redirect over to the legacy namespace because we're talking to 2007, and that's where the legacy namespace exists. And then the Exchange 2007 CAS server will then proxy the communication to the 2000 CAS server here, and then that CAS server will talk to 2007. Now, one thing I want to point out in particular about this scenario, there was really no good way to get the line from that 2007 CAS to that 2007 CAS. It does not, the communication does not go through the 2013 CAS, but really, where was the line going to go at this point? So, yeah, all the way down and back up, and then it looks like it's moving around the site. So, this is what we have. This is what it is. It doesn't go through the 2013 CAS. With one exception, and it's not Outlook Web App. It actually will do that if you are an active sync user going through Exchange 2013 to try to connect to a 2007 mailbox. Then in that case, we will actually proxy you automatically through a mailbox on 2013, through the system mailbox on 2013 to get to there. But this communication for OWA does not do that. All right, the last scenario, I'm sure you can imagine how this goes. Now we do have a namespace here at the second site. So IIS finds them over here. We find they've got an external URL. Now we can just redirect over to that external URL and complete the conversation that way. Again, the key is it's all single sign-on and silent redirection in all of these scenarios except for the proxy scenario, which is still single sign-on and silent. All right, how many of you are deploying Edge? All right, let's talk about Edge. There's really only two prerequisites for Edge. Edge is super simple to deploy. You install Active Directory, Lightweight Directory Services, and you don't even need to create any instances. You just install that feature, and that's it. Then when you run Edge Setup, it will automatically create all the instances that it needs. The only other prerequisite that you have is that the machine, if it's not domain joined, and we do support Edge transport servers being part of a perimeter network domain, great for management, but if it's not domain joined, you have to go in and you have to give it a fully qualified domain name and then restart the computer. That is a requirement. We need an FQDN because this is a transport server. Otherwise, those are the only requirements for Edge, aside from the same system requirements you saw earlier. All right. After you've done that, then you'll create an Edge subscription file. And this is the file that will then be sneaker-netted or USB-sticked from your Edge Transport server over to an internal mailbox server. Remember, mailbox is where Hub lives now, so the Edge subscription goes from Edge Transport over to the mailbox server now. So you export it, you import it then on the mailbox, and you create the Edge subscription. And then it will automatically create the connectors for you. And the source transport server names, those will be the names of the Edge subscription once you install your first Edge transport server. All right, and you'll see evidence of that if you do get Exchange Server. Once you have the Edge subscription configured, you do get Exchange Server, and Edge will start showing up in the list of servers. So Edge can basically be introduced at any time. It is compatible with 2007 and 2010. It can also be the source, both inbound and outbound, for all of your mail. It is something that's optional, but it does provide you with a perimeter network SMTP gateway that is capable of exchange authentication, which is the primary reason that we introduced it. That's what customers wanted. They wanted a perimeter gateway, perimeter network SMTP gateway that could do exchange authentication. All right. Now, for mail flow, in terms of when you do the cutover to Edge, if you're going to deploy Edge first right away because you want all mail to go through that, then do it that way. But otherwise, if Edge is going to come after the fact, wait till about maybe half of your users have been migrated. That seems to be about when mail flow is really 50-50 in either place. So that's a pretty reasonable place to go ahead and make that cutover and just start using Edge completely for all your mail. And again, that's just a simple MX record change at that point. All right, for moving mailboxes, that's pretty easy in Exchange 2013. Yes, it was easy in previous versions, but now we've improved it. Of course, there are commandlets that you can use, but you've got a full fidelity wizard inside the Exchange Admin Center that can do things like move mailboxes in batches, including multiple batches. It also has some new Symantec and retry logic in it. It's got reporting built into it, throttling built into it, and so forth. So you definitely want to leverage EAC where possible, because it will be significantly easier, even when you're doing bulk moves, than using the command line. But you can use the command line if you want. It's just a lot easier to use the GUI. For managing coexistence, it's simple. If you're in a coexistence state, use the 2013 tools to manage 2013 objects. Use the 2007 tools to manage 2007 objects. Use the 2010 tools to manage 2010 objects. It's pretty simple and straightforward. All right, let's talk about public folders. So we have radically changed the public folder architecture in Exchange 2013. There are, in fact, no more public folder databases. Okay. No more public folder databases. Public folder in Exchange 2013 is now simply a type of mailbox. And you can have multiple public folder mailboxes, and each of the mailboxes contains a single copy of the data. Okay? There's no more public folder replicas because we don't have public folder datas. So if you want a replica, a high availability copy of your data, whatever mailboxes that you're creating your public folders on, you should deploy them in a database availability group and use continuous replication to give you copies of that data. Otherwise, in the absence of that, there's no replication. There's no multi-master experience anymore either. It's all single master. The copy, the content exists in one place and only one place. And if a user needs to edit it or change it, that's the mailbox that they're connecting to. Now, the hierarchy, though, which is the public folder tree, that's copied everywhere, to every public folder mailbox that you have. There's one that is writable, the others are read-only, but every public folder mailbox gets a copy so that any client can connect to it and see the tree right away and browse and so forth. But when they choose a folder and they open some content, they're going to that specific public folder mailbox. Now, we call the existing public folders in 2007 and 2010, we call those legacy public folders. 2013, we call the new ones modern public folders. Now, an Exchange 2013 mailbox user can access both legacy and modern public folders. But an Exchange 2007 or 2010 mailbox user can only access legacy public folders. That is why I said earlier you want to move all of your users, or at least all the users that require public folders, before you move the public folders from legacy to modern. If you do the public folder move first, you could end up locking out your users until their mailboxes are moved. Now, the way it goes is we've got tools for you to use. The tool will first analyze your existing public folder structure. It will just walk the tree, list out all the different folders, how much content is in them, when they've been last touched, et cetera, et cetera. And it will create this text mapping file that you can then edit if you don't want to migrate all of your data. But otherwise, by design, it's going to look at everything and prepare for migrating all of your data. Then the process will begin by copying the public folder data in the background. We use the mailbox replication service to do this asynchronously in the background. We'll get up to about 95% of the public folder data migrated, and then we'll put it in a holding pattern until the administrator comes along and pulls the trigger and proceeds with the upgrade. At that point, the legacy public folders become locked. The rest of the data that hasn't been migrated over goes over to the modern public folders, and the modern public folders get unlocked once that happens, and then users can get into them. So let me walk you through the animation. So first, again, it's going to be the same process, because you've already done this stuff to get your mailboxes over. So all the updates, migrating all the users. Then you're going to run through that analysis process, snapshot the folders, all the children, everything that you have in there. It's going to calculate it all. Then it's going to create new public folder mailboxes, but it's going to set a parameter called hold from migration. And this creates the mailboxes, but makes them invisible so clients don't see them yet. But we need them created because, again, we're starting to move the data in the background now. So that we know that's going to take a while for some customers. So the data is migrated in the background after you create the migration request. And then after it gets to a certain point, it just auto-suspends itself. And then it's waiting for the administrator to finalize the process. After they finalize the process, the source gets locked, clients get kicked off, the rest of the data gets moved over, and the new one gets unlocked. And then the admin will typically go in and validate the folders, and everything's good to go. Users will have the same experience in Outlook and Outlook Web App. It's going to be the same public folder experience, but again, behind the scenes, things are really different. Now, if you wanted to, there is a process to go back to legacy public folders. But remember, they're locked as soon as you move to modern public folders. So as soon as you start generating new content in the modern public folders, that's content that potentially could be lost if you went back to legacy public folders. So we would actually prefer, if you really wanted to do that, that you called in support and got our help with that to make sure that any new data you created in modern public folders gets back into legacy public folders as well. Because basically, the legacy public folders will be stuck in time at the moment they are locked. So no new data will go into them. So it will be like you went back to that day on the migration. All right, yes, sir. I'm sorry, one more time.
Are the new public folders supporting the forms?
Yes. So the question is, do the modern public folders support the forms or the org forms libraries? Yes, absolutely, we do. And there's instructions for how to move that over as well. All right. One thing to be aware of, though, is if you have any Exchange Web Services clients, once their mailbox has been moved to the new system, they won't be able to access the legacy public folders, unfortunately. So that would be the Entourage, Outlook for the Mac, or if you're doing any custom EWS scripts into public folders, those could break as well. Once the public folders have been moved from the legacy system to modern public folders, then those clients will have access again and they'll be able to get back in. So keep that in mind. It's a bit ironic since we tell you to move the users first. All right, some miscellaneous things. We want you to watch out for offline address book downloads, because we've seen organizations, when they introduce a new version of Exchange into their environment, that first server also creates its own offline address book. And that OAB is going to be a duplicate of the OAB you already have on your existing servers. But that doesn't matter to Outlook clients. If an Outlook client sees even the same OAB, but it's on a different server, it does a full and complete download of that OAB again. Okay, so we want you to watch out for that, and we've got some tricks for you to get around that. So first is you're going to want to know which servers are your OAB servers. And you can just simply use the get mailbox with the arbitration switch. And then you're looking for the persisted capabilities, particularly organization capability of OAB gen. That says that this server can download or can generate the whole offline address book, the default offline address book, and give it out to any authenticated client that's asking for it. All right, so, and this unfortunately is just a side effect of us wanting to make sure that clients could always have the most up-to-date address book. So here's an example where a client will see the same exact offline address book, but on a server in Boston and on another server in Seattle. Now, if that client is located on Seattle, they're going to do their OAB download from Seattle, and that's going to be fast. But if they're now talking to a server in Boston, which is the other side of the country in the United States, that's going to slow things down considerably. And of course, they're also downloading stuff they don't need because they've already gotten the same exact information from another server. Now, some folks have thought, well, I should just put the OAB servers in different sites and then just replicate locally for local high availability. But it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. This scenario still doesn't matter because as long as you've got users that can span sites, that user could go from one site to another. So anytime that database fails over or an admin switches it over between sites, that user's now going to see the other OAB and download it all again, even though they don't need to. So generally what we recommend is that you just have one OAB mailbox per your entire organization. And that can be on any server that you want. Just have the one. And of course, just make sure it's in a DAG, and particularly within a mailbox that is replicated to another site. And that way you get site resilience for your OAB server. All right, Kerberos authentication. Kerberos is something we've been talking about for a while in Exchange, started in 2010. We noticed that some of our very larger customers were running into severe NTLM bottlenecks when their users would all rush to log on and authenticate, like Monday mornings and so forth. So we introduced support for Kerberos. It's not enabled by default. It's something that the administrator has to go in and enable and configure a few things like credentials and so forth. And then once that's done, though, if you do enable it, that will set the appropriate authentication methods within both Exchange and IIS. Some will be set to Kerberos. Others will be set to Negotiate, or Nego for short. The OAB directories are applications within IIS, so that stuff will happen automatically, so you don't have to convert them like you did in Exchange 2010. So the process is actually a lot easier. Even though it's similar, it's a lot easier in 2013. So here's a little decision tree that you can use to figure out if you should enable Kerberos in your environment. So first, if you're pure Exchange 2013, yes. Enable it for both the RPC and the MAPI directories. RPC being the Outlook Anywhere virtual directory, and the slash MAPI being the new virtual directory we introduced for the MAPI over HTTP protocol. If you're not pure 2013, do you have legacy public folders? If you don't, then you can enable Kerberos. If you do, do you have CU5 or later deployed? Exchange 2013 Cumulative Update 5. That's the update we released immediately after Service Pack 1 and the update we released right before CU6, which is our later one. So as long as you're on CU5 or later, we introduced Kerberos support for legacy public folders in that update. You could go ahead and enable Kerberos. If you're not, then we would recommend migrating your public folders to Exchange 2013 when you can. And then once you've done that, the answer of legacy public folders becomes no. And then you can enable Kerberos for RPC and MAPI. All right, we still will use, for the legacy server-to-server communication, the servers themselves will still use NTLM as well. But for client authentication, which was the source of the bottleneck, now the clients will be using Kerberos authentication instead. All right. Now, there are some changes. The setup, as I said, is a lot simpler. We only require the HTTP service principal names now because all client traffic is largely HTTP, including Outlook again through Outlook Anywhere or MAPI over HTTP. So as a result of doing that, that also makes Kerberos a lot easier. And then you can see if you are in a coexistence environment or a complex environment that has maybe both 2007 and 2010 in it, you can see, you'll see a little bit of both depending on the protocol that's used. You can see HTTP would be the MAPI over HTTP protocol. RPC over HTTP, of course, is Outlook Anywhere. So you can see all the connections that are being made through MAPI over HTTP are being made with Kerberos or Negotiate. And all the legacy stuff or anything that's Outlook Anywhere is still using the NTLM. All right. Quotas. This is the last thing I want to talk about. Quotas have changed, but in a strange way. So in Exchange 2010, when we reported the size of a mailbox, the information that we gave you was largely the size that was visible to the end user, the total count and size of all of their items and all their folders and everything. But the fact of the matter is every user mailbox has a whole bunch of other stuff, indices, other tables, all this other things that you don't see unless you're using a low-level or raw MAPI viewer. There's lots more data that's actually in each user's mailboxes. So in Exchange 2013, we decide to tell you the actual amount of space that it occupies on disk. Now, that number has not changed between 2010 and 2013. If I have a 1 gigabyte mailbox, and by 1 gigabyte, I mean my mailbox occupied a gigabyte of space on disk, it will occupy a gigabyte of space on disk in Exchange 2013 as well. But in 2010, we told you that that 1 gigabyte mailbox was only 500 megabytes or 700 megabytes, depending on the compression ratio. So there was a lot more to it. So what that means is as you're moving mailboxes, if you're using mailbox size limits, you might need to adjust them, particularly if you have users that are approaching 65, 70, or 75% of their quota, of their size limit. And this is because once you move the mailbox, the true size limit will be reported to the system. And the quota enforcers will say, nope, you're full, even though they were already there. So you'll need to increase the quota commensurately, but that doesn't mean that the mailbox size changes. It doesn't. It doesn't mean that the database gets bigger. It doesn't. Nothing has changed other than in 2010, we lied about the size of the mailbox, and in 2013, we tell you the truth. That's the only change that's happened here. But now that the truth is known, the tools need to be adjusted so that they can operate on reality versus the diminished view that we gave you. But it's important to understand that your databases and your mailboxes are not getting bigger as a result of this. Just the number is bigger because it's the truth now. All right. So in summary, you've seen that you're going to need updates for coexistence. Whether you're coming from 2007 or 2010, you may have some stuff that you need to install. There's a few steps that it will take you to get to Exchange 2013, but they're not too difficult. And we have a whole lot of tools that will walk you through the entire process, start to finish. We've got Edge Transport Server now in there. So for those of you who want to deploy Edge, we've made that super simple to do that. So simple, in fact, that even if you've never ever used Edge Transport in your entire life, I would guarantee that within 5 minutes or less, you can have a fully functional Edge Transport server up and running for your org. I guarantee that. And then use our deployment assistant. It is our best tool to make sure that you can deploy your servers the way Microsoft recommends and the way that you're going to get the best performance and value out of them. All right, so there's some related content, not too much left that might be related to on-premises Exchange administrators. I hope in particular you'll come to my high availability session tomorrow. We'll talk a lot about both high availability and site resilience, and I'll have at the end a pretty cool announcement to make too, so hopefully you'll show up for that. We actually have about 11 minutes left, and I still have a couple wristbands here, so I'm going to hand them out to people who ask very good questions. And FYI, a very good question is not can I have a wristband, okay? So let's just not do that right away. So, and of course we do have Ask the Experts later, so if we don't get to everybody's question, come to Ask the Experts right after this, where I'm told there may be as many as 100 extra wristbands there. Okay, I think you had your hand up first.
Yes, I don't know, I don't think it's a good question, but how do you decommission the old servers? So just uninstalling or I...
Great. That, you know what? That is a good question. What do you think? Does everybody think that's a good question? How do you decommission your old servers? Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. And that's particularly great because, quite honestly, we have been terrible about documenting how to do that. But the process is very similar, so literally you could follow the guidance that we have for how to decommission your last Exchange 2010 server or your last 2007 server. The process is the same. Once you moved all the data off, once that server is no longer responsible for roles, it's not OAB gen, it's not doing expansion, it doesn't have it's not the source server for connectors, et cetera, et cetera. As long as the server is completely idle, the first thing you'll probably want to do is just do a normal power off and leave it off for maybe a week or two and see if anything breaks. As long as nothing breaks, then you can proceed with a normal uninstall. You'll want to go through control panel, add, remove, and actually use the setup program to remove that server so it can do an orderly removal from AD. If you try to hack it out, there's way too many backlinks and way too many references. Other servers will still think it's there and try to talk to it. So just do the normal uninstall process once you're sure that the server's not doing anything anymore. Great question. Let's see, I think over here in the blue. Gotta watch that first step. All right, right here.
The public folder quota of number of public folders that is possible in 2013 is 100,000.
Yes.
Are you going to increase that?
Eventually, yes. We've said that.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so if you didn't hear, the question was around increasing the limits around public folders. We're actually hoping, possibly, and you know, your mileage may vary and we might not hit it, but the next leap we want to do is around 1 million. So we'll be hitting the scales very hard. Over here.
Okay, so we are at 2010 in hybrid mode. Are there any special considerations for upgrading them?
Oh, that is a good question. What do you think, audience?
Yeah.
Trust me, there's plenty more wristbands at Ask the Experts, so I think that's a great one. Thank you. How many of you are also in hybrid mode? All right, a few of you. So to answer your question directly, yes, there are some special considerations that you have to do. We actually have a whole deploying Exchange Hybrid session that happened earlier today, so I don't know if you got to see that where they talked about that stuff. If you haven't, download the presentation from the website. But hybrid does require a lot of the same steps because you will be introducing a 2013 server into the organization. It's not required, but you'll get the best experience. You can still do hybrid with 2010. But once you introduce 2013, a lot of the steps that you saw today are a lot of the same things you're going to have to do in terms of the prereqs, updating Active Directory, possibly moving certificates around, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So we'll still take some questions. I'm out of wristbands, but we'll get you some later on at Ask the Experts.
Oh, thank you. What's about forefront protection for Exchange? Is still available for 2013?
Sorry, say that one more time.
What's about forefront protection for Exchange?
So what about forefront for Exchange? So now you would want to look at something like Exchange Online Protection. So the forefront brands, you may have noticed most of those are gone. Exchange Online Protection is the latest version, so it would be the replacement for forefront, and that would be the long-term replacement that we would have for you. Over here.
There were a few things about certificates, and there is a plan for supporting TLS 1.2 for SMTP. thinking things of perfect forward secrecy and so.
Sure, so the question was around TLS 1.2 support for SMTP. That's on the roadmap, but I don't have any ETA for you.
So in Exchange 2013, the single instance store does not anymore exist. Is it true?
Ooh.
So then we have to calculate much more space when you migrate?
Great question. So in 2013, single instance storage is gone. Is it true? Yes, it's true, but it's been true for a while. In 2007, single instance storage only existed for bodies and subject and things like that. We didn't do it for attachments anymore. In 2010, it was completely removed. So it's been gone for a while. Remember, single instance storage, if you're not familiar with it, it's not really deduplication, but if I sent a message to 10 people, the system would create one copy and then give pointers out to that one copy to those 10 people, as long as they existed on the same database. That feature was created at a time, remember, when disks were tiny, 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 and so we optimized for space, not for performance, which is why 5.5, 2000, 2003, they all needed heavy storage to back them up. Beginning with 2003, as disks got larger and larger, we began to optimize for performance and less optimization went in for space. And now the size that disks are today, you know, we've actually optimized Exchange 2013 for 8 terabyte drives, and we did that years before those drives are available. And so we've optimized all now for performance, not single instance storage. The thing it is, though, single instance storage really only gave you benefits in certain scenarios. And as email grew and grew and grew, and as organizations grew and grew and grew, the optimizations that you got were fewer and farther between. And unfortunately, the internal plumbing and calculations around the single instance storage ratio caused all the reporting and the performance counters to be completely wrong. So even if we did have to have you recalculate it, we wouldn't give you a number that you could use to recalculate, because the ratio that you get is completely meaningless. If you've ever looked in Perfmon and seen that, you can completely ignore that counter because it's totally broken. But sys, the short answer is yes, completely gone. It's nothing really to be worried about in terms of space or anything like that. All right, let's go over here now.
We use a lot of mail-enabled public folders. Is there anything that we need to look at when we're moving them to the new type of public folder?
Come see me for a wristband. An excellent question. They use a lot of mail-enabled public folders. Is there anything that you need to do? Yes, there will be. When you're in the migration process of moving the public folders, and you've actually hit the button and you're ready to finalize it, when the legacy public folders get locked, all mail that will be sent to them will end up in your transport queues. And they'll actually be stuck there until the migration is done. You won't be able to do anything until the migration is completed and the modern public folders have been unlocked. And at that point, you need to actually restart the transport service on every server that has them stuck in the queue, and that's how you unfree them. You won't be able to go in and do retry or force delivery. It has to be a restart of the transport service to unstick that stuff. And then once that's done, then mail will start coming into the new modern public folders, and life will be back to normal for you. Ooh. Sorry.
We also let our users send us public folders. Is there any difference for that as well?
Great, yeah, no. So the experience from the end user's perspective will not change. It's only from the admin experience that is very different now. All right, great question. Let's go, going down here now, I'll get to you. And again, if we don't get to your question, we have Ask the Experts right after this, so plenty of time for everyone. Who is it? Right here.
Hello.
Hello.
This is probably just quite a simple question, but in terms of the certificate simplification that you're doing, so for example, if you've got 2010, you've got webmail pointed to 2010, you've got auto-discover, you bring 2013 into place and you redirect your namespace and you copy the certificate across. My understanding and what I'm reading in an article is that when it proxies, is it builds the FQDN of the Exchange server. So how does that build an SSL HTTPS connection to it if that name isn't on the certificate?
That's a great question. So we don't use the name that it builds. we still use the name that's assigned to the server. So you'll see that strange name that it builds in a few places, but in terms of the actual connectivity and the SSL communication, that's not the name that we're using there.
Okay, so even though this CAPS 2010, so this isn't going to appear on the certificate, but it won't have a problem using HTTPS to connect to this. If you see what I mean.
Well, let's take this offline because I don't know whose example that is. Here you go.
How about IMAP in coexistence with 2013 and 2010?
Ah, great. Great question. So how about IMAP? We fully support IMAP. There's nothing...
Legacy.
Yes, it will work, but the IMAP settings will still point to the legacy server. It won't be a proxy or redirection. All right, let's come back this way.
So you talked about Kerberos earlier, and one of the things I saw was missing there was alternate service accounts. Are they still required?
Ah, great question. So that's actually... Okay, great. Great. So that's actually up to you. There's a couple appendix slides that talk about the pros and cons of using either. And so I would recommend downloading the deck and checking that out. All right, I've also been given the hook to get off stage, so I will get you at Ask the Experts. So thank you very much for coming. Hoping to see you at the session tomorrow or at Ask the Experts tonight. Thanks.